And last night, during the question time, I did promise I'll talk a little bit about walking meditation. And the second half of the talk, I'll just go over some of the problems in meditation again and how they're overcome. But first of all, that many of you have been practicing walking meditation, and it's one of the four postures encouraged by the Buddha, and it has become a very good meditation in and of itself. And you see the way this meditation hall has been constructed. On three sides we have these beautiful walking meditation halls, which means you don't have to go that far to be able to walk. If you go to our monastery over the road, or to the Nuns' Monastery in Dharamsala, you see that there we've built covered walking meditations right outside the door of the hut. Exactly the same reason. When it's convenient to do walking meditation, you find you do more. And it's one of the beautiful ways of learning how to calm the mind down and bring it to a state of stillness. With walking meditation, especially in these halls or on the covered walking paths at our monasteries, you stand at one end, you go to the other end, and then you go back again. And as I said, I think on the first night, there's something very beautiful about that, something very, very Buddhist. You just go back to where you started from again and again and again and again. Just like the wheel of rebirth, going round and round again, from birth to death, back to birth again. So just the same way, you start at one end of the path, and then a sort of 2 minutes later, you're getting nowhere. Because the idea is not to get anywhere. It's to be where you are and stand still rather than keep on moving backwards and forwards in life. Always thinking you're getting somewhere, but you know what it's like. Where you start off is where you end. There's people are going to get upset at me about this, but there's a very, very old joke. And I'm sure some of you have heard this many times in Nanavara, about these two old people. They're sitting in a park in the evening, and one of them says to the other, "Oh, it's just so terrible to be old. And I'm 75 now, my legs ache, my arms ache, I can hardly hear, and my sight is going, and I feel terrible, I can't sleep very well at night. It's really tough being old. What about you?" And the other guy says, "Being old, I love being old. I'm 80 years old and I feel like a newborn baby." You know this one. "What do you mean a newborn baby?" "Well, I've got no teeth, I've got no hair, and I've just wet my pants again." So that's another indication that even in this life, we start in one place, we finish straight back where we began. Wetting our pants and wearing nappies once more. So walking meditation is like that. So we go backwards and forwards, and that's very important. You're not going anywhere or getting anywhere. You're being where you are. And in order to be where we are, so when we can actually do the walking meditation in these rooms, or there's many paths throughout this center, or in the bush. And again, it's one of the nice things here. We've got space to do your walking meditation wherever you want. It is good to get a simple path. That's why we have many covered walkways. Because if you walk in the bush, then sometimes you just have to be concerned where you're walking. It may be a twig, it may be an ant, it may be a little rock there which you have to avoid. So it's more complicated. It gives you more things to do walking in the bush. So walking on a nice, safe path is much easier. So when you do your walking meditation, your eyes should be open, but just gazing down about 2 meters in front of you. We say about 2 meters because that's not too distant, not too close. It means you can see just what's coming up ahead in the next sort of few seconds when you're walking. So it gives you a sense of safety that you're not going to sort of step onto something which is going to bite you or sort of trip over something. So you keep your gaze about 2 meters in front of you on the ground. But you don't look to the left. You don't look to the right. You don't look at the birds flying overhead. You focus. So just actually putting your eyes 2 meters in front of you and keeping them there takes a little bit of restraint. Again, the effort not to do. Not to look over here and look over there and look somewhere else. Because that type of looking is just pure restlessness. No, the only task which you need to do is to look 2 meters ahead. Not right to the end of the path and see how much more path you've got to walk. Not looking back to see how much you've already walked. But just this moment now, just 2 meters ahead, where you're going to walk to. So that's the first part of the walking meditation, where you put your eyes. And the second part of the walking meditation is to walk naturally. You don't have to walk slow. Some people like walking fast. Some people like walking slow. But when you have this walking meditation horse, when you're walking and two or three people are also walking in there, it comes a competition of how slow you can walk. Because you feel there must be something wrong with me. You know, if I were walking backwards and forwards, and these other, they walk so slowly. So I better walk slowly too. So it becomes the slow walking competition. Don't do that. Don't look at what other people are doing. You know, it's just what you feel you need to do. So if you want to walk fast, you walk fast. Get a sweat up. For those people who want to walk slow, walk slow. So there's no rule there, whether you should walk fast or you should walk slow. It's usually more common that people start walking slow when they start meditating, simply because things do slow down. In the same way your walking slows down. That's natural. You know, when you're really stressed out, lots of things to do, and your mind is very restless, of course, you know, people walk fast. That's their nature too. So it's usually the nature to walk slow, but don't just follow just the average. You do what you feel you need to do. And of course, what we do when we walk in meditation, instead of allowing our eyes to go backwards and forwards, even though we put our eyes just in front of us, and instead of our mind going backwards and forwards, we also put our mind on the task of walking. So when I do walking meditation, I like to tie it in to exactly the same sort of thing we do in the breath meditation. First of all, just present moment. Well, first of all, just make sure your body's comfortable. And then do some present moment awareness. So just put those two guards. You know, not looking at the present moment, but looking at the past, looking at the future to stop them coming in. Just sort of two bodyguards to make sure that you are in the moment and you don't go thinking of what's going to happen at lunchtime, what you're going to do this afternoon and planning out your whole day. Or even worse, planning what you're going to do when you leave here. So all those plans which you might have, please, this is no time for planning on this meditation retreat. I usually leave this to the last day, but on the last day, usually the night before, I think, well, if we finish off, was it lunchtime or 3 o'clock? I don't know what time we finish off. I haven't got to that place yet. But usually people are all packed the night before, which is absolutely crazy. There's one of the stories in the book, which is a great story about not planning for the future. There was this monk I used to know. His name was Ham Wall. He was a New Zealand monk, but he ordained in the Korean tradition. And he was in a very great monastery. The teacher became very famous. He died about 10 or 15 years ago. The teacher was very famous, and it was a very strict monastery. And every year they would do a retreat, a monastic retreat, 60 days, a 2-month retreat, not 9 days, but 60 days. And there was none of this Ajahn Brahm, yeah, if you feel tired, go to bed and have a sleep business. This was Korean and this was tough. You get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and you couldn't sort of carry on sleeping, you couldn't hide, because you slept in the meditation hall. Just right where you were sitting, that's where you lay down. So 3 o'clock in the morning, the bell went, everybody up. So there's no way you could carry on sitting, because everyone could ever sleeping. Everyone could see you straight up, and it was, I think, 50 minutes sitting, 10 minutes walking. 50 sitting, 10 minutes walking. When it came down to breakfast, even then you couldn't move. The breakfast was brought in front of you. And the only time you could get out is to go to the toilet. But it's like some prison. I'm not sure if a guard had to accompany you to the toilet or whatever. But it's something like that. Or the only other time you could get out is to have an interview with the master. And the master, again, was polar opposite to myself. He was like something out of like a Stalag concentration camp. So even though you were very painful, apparently, you preferred just to enjoy the pain than going to an interview with the master. And it was like that until 10 o'clock at night. And then you could go to bed where you're sitting. And he said, sort of, this was a very tough retreat. So imagine all that sitting. And if you've got aches and pains in your leg, you imagine this poor guy. You know, he was in New Zealand. He wasn't born in Asia, so he didn't know how to sit on the floor. But he was a very, very tough and strong man. So he really put a lot of effort into his sitting. And it doesn't matter how painful it was, he'd carry on. But what really pissed him off was at 10 o'clock, when he wanted to go and have a sleep, some of these others, you know what it's like, these smart aleck monks, they'd still be sitting there till midnight. Come on, guys, a bit of solidarity. You sleep and I'll sleep too. So he was doing this, and after about 4 or 5 days, he told me he was in incredible pain. You know, the whole body was aching. Because, you know, didn't have any exercise, hardly any rest. They did some walking meditation, 10 minutes of it, but it was very slow, you know, on the outside, the circle of the meditation hall. And after, you know, a few days of that, he was just had enough. But, you know, all the other ones, all the other Asians, you know, he was a Westerner, he thought, I'm not going to be outdone by these guys. It was racist and sort of arrogance and pride, which kept him going for another sort of 10 days. And after 2 weeks, you know, he really was at his end. But then he started thinking, no, he's already done 2 weeks. If he gave up now, all of that pain and endurance which he put into, you know, 2 weeks of meditating would be lost, would be for nothing. It was almost as if he would be unfaithful to what he'd endured. So that thought kept him going and kept him going. You know, minute by minute he just endured. And, you know, he did eventually come to the 4 week mark, the halfway mark. And at the halfway mark, you know, they think, well, I've done, you know, I'm halfway there, I'm on the home stretch. You know how sort of, you know, your psychology goes into denial. About 4 weeks is a long time. And it's not going to be the same as the first 4 weeks, it's going to get worse. So he really struggled. It was the most difficult thing he had ever done in his whole life. And he endured so much until it finally came to the last morning of the retreat. He'd done 59 days, and it was really a lot of endurance. And even though it was only like the last day of the retreat, that last day just dragged on and on and on. When it gets to the last day, you know, 1 hour is like 10 days long. But finally, like, it has to happen, all things must pass. It got to the last meditation, the last 50 minutes. And in that tradition, you know, after the retreat was over, they had almost like a party, like hot baths, like they have in Korea. And he was just dreaming and drooling about the hot bath, because his whole body aches. And they had this big meal and feast afterwards. And then the next days you could relax and have some fun and catch up on your sleep and enjoy yourself. And so the last 50 minutes he was just dreaming of just what was going to happen afterwards. And then after about sort of 45 minutes, he opened his eyes to see only 5 minutes left, and he realized there was another 40 minutes left. He couldn't believe that the time was going so slow. And that's when he said that he looked at the clock and wondered if the batteries had run out. And he started thinking, what happens if the batteries did go dead and the clock got stopped? And that was his... The last 50 minutes, he said, just dragged and dragged and dragged. But of course, as it must happen, the 50 minutes were finished. Oh, that was the sweetest sound he'd ever heard in his life. Oh, and his whole body was, even though it was in pain, suffused with joy. You know, you've done something very, very difficult. 60 days of such tough meditation. You endured so much, and now it's the end. Oh, it was just bliss. Bring on the hot bars. Let's have some cakes and tea. And he was just getting up to bow when the bell went again. Excuse me, before you leave, said the meditation master, I have an announcement to make. Many of the monks on this retreat have been telling me just how rewarding it's been and what a wonderful retreat this has been. And they've requested that we extend it for another 10 days. I think that's a wonderful thing to do. Carry on meditating. It's a true story. And this monk, he had to cross his legs again and start meditating, but he said he never felt any pain. Because his mind was totally consumed with anger. And he was trying to figure out who those damn smart-ass monks were who made that suggestion and what he was going to do to them when he found out, which wasn't at all Buddhist. And then when he was contemplating how he was going to kill them slowly after much painful torture, the bell rang again. About 20 minutes had gone past in a couple of seconds. And the master said, "Retreat's over. Go and get your bath." And he couldn't figure out what's going on. Are we carrying on? Or is it over? What's happening? He was totally confused, at which point another monk came up to him and said, "Now that mastery does this every year." And that, he said, he learned more on that experience at the end of the retreat than he had over the whole 60 days. He realized the pain was all about expectation. And because he'd been trying to wish away the days, and eventually get to the last day, the last 50 minutes, the last 5 minutes, the last minute was over, and then we're carrying on for another 10 days. So you don't know what's going to happen when you pack your bags on next Sunday. Who knows, some of you might suggest. We carry on for another 10 days. For those of you, and this is a real possibility, who are going back over to Brisbane or Melbourne or Sydney or Singapore or whatever, there might be a plane strike. The aircraft, I know Qantas is having industrial problems, and they do all the baggage handling and other servicing at the Perth airport. So it might happen that you can't go home. So, another 10 days. The purpose of that is we don't send our mind off into the future. We don't have expectations. Tentative plans for sure, but not great plans. And so when you're doing walking meditation, you're having no plans. It's just the next step is all you're worried about. So you keep your mind in the present moment, not going anywhere. You go there, you come back again. So what have you achieved? You've achieved the wonderful state of doing nothing, of going nowhere, of being no one. And that's our goal. Our goal is not to go anywhere, but to be here. Not to be someone who has all these attainments, so you can go back home and you can say, "Yes, I got first jhana on this retreat. Hooray, next retreat I'm going to go for second jhana on the next retreat. Or I became a stream winner, I became arahat." And you know, I gave you little stars. You know, if you're sort of first jhana, you get 1 star. Second jhana, 2 stars. And so you can proudly go back home and you wear your sort of 2 stars as authorized by Ajahn Brahm. We don't do that. It's not about attaining things. It's about letting go, about being here. Not being somewhere, not going anywhere. But being in this moment. So when you're walking meditation, you're just there. Just being, just walking. In this very moment. No past, no future. And that hopefully will settle you in the moment. And of course, walking backwards and forwards, there's not much to think about, is there? Now what can you sort of say about a step? When I was at school, that one of the teachers there, he had a bit of a sense of humour, but you know, when any of the kids misbehaved, you know, instead of actually, you know, putting them in detention, he would make them write an essay. You know, those teachers used to make you write essays if you misbehaved? But he'd have all these very interesting things to make the kids write about. And one of his favourite ones, write an essay 2 pages long about the inside of a ping pong ball. There's not much you could write about the inside of a ping pong ball. Not even the outside, but the inside, it's white. What else can you write about it? And it's the same with walking meditations. It is about as interesting as the inside of a ping pong ball. So there's nothing much to think about it, is there? Which is one of the whole purposes, to keep it so simple. You can also see that on the walls of this meditation hall and in the walking meditation halls, there are no pictures. There are no sort of murals. There's nothing which you say, oh, that's interesting. But look at that painting. It's just a brick. And all the bricks are the same. And they're not particularly interesting bricks. They're boring bricks, chosen for the lack of interest. So all you can do is just nothing. Nothing much to think about. Which is the whole purpose, being still. It is sensory deprivation in those walking meditation halls. Backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. And there's a point to that, because after a while, nothing to think about, you stop thinking. So the same way we have these little stages in the breath meditation, present moment awareness and silence, it's the same with the walking meditation. Let that develop first of all. It's more important than even being aware of your feet, is being aware of the moment and being silent. Because those are the two things which are the foundation of mindfulness, present moment awareness and silence. If you can build up those things during this retreat, you will have a wonderful time. In the silence, you'll be able to hear the sound of the birds. You'll be able to hear the sound of the wind rustling through the trees. You'll be able to hear the sound of my intestines gurgling. In silence, you can hear all these amazing sounds. And it's also, you can hear the Dhamma as well. Soft voice of nature's truth teaching you, only in the silence. So that's why we're developing these things as priorities. And once you're into some silence, then it's very easy just to watch the movement of the feet in the same way you watch the breath go in and out when you're doing sitting meditation. So when you're watching the walking meditation, just watch your feet. Left foot's moving. Right foot's moving. The left step. The right step. Got to the end of the path. Turning around. Left step, right step. You don't need to say those things to yourself, left, right. You just know them. In the same way with the breath meditation, once you start to notice the breath, you start to notice more and more of the breath, until you can see the breath from the very beginning of an in-breath to its end. See from the very beginning of an out-breath to its end, and even see the spaces between the breath. In the same way when you're walking meditation, you can feel the very first sensation which tells you the foot is actually moving off from the mat. You can ask yourself, which part of your foot leaves the ground first? Which last? Is the heel, the ball of the foot, a toe? What moves first? What moves last? As you lift the foot off the ground. And how does it move upwards? Is it vertical, straight up? Or is it an angle to the ground? How does it move? And then what does it do? To go forward. And then what part of the foot meets the ground first? What next? What last? And what happens between the movement of the feet from one left foot to right foot? You can see the weight of your body move from one foot to another so that it leaves the other foot free to lift up and also step forward. So you start to see the whole of the one step, rather than just left, right. And as you keep moving, you go to the next stage of walking meditation. I link this with the breath meditation to the delightful walking. Because it's not just noticing all these sensations. Because you're very still and focused, it becomes really interesting and even joyful. And you're just happily walking, feeling quite content and quite delighted in just watching all these amazing sensations in your feet as you walk. When that happens, again, you've got to a great stage of meditation. Just carry on and enjoy to the max. You're focusing, the mind is becoming more and more still, and the sign of a still mind is the happiness and joy which comes up. So when those sorts of things happen, when you really start to see lots and lots of the feelings in the feet as you walk, that is usually when you start going very slow. Not because you want to, it's just because there's so much going on, you can't rush it. It's just too much to do all in one go. and the meditation makes you really peaceful and very still. You can't really get into the jhanas on a walking meditation. And I don't really think it's possible. Only Ajahn Yana once told me, you know, he tells some tall stories sometimes. They're very funny, so I don't begrudge him his tall stories. They make life more interesting. But anyway, if it's not true, it may be true. And anyway, maybe it should be true. But one of these monks he met said, yeah, he did get into jhanas when he was doing walking meditation. He got so still. And he said the proof of that was all the cuts and bruises on his forehead. Because when he got into jhana, he didn't know what his body was up to. He just carried on walking. So he kept on bumping into things. So I thought it was a really good story, but I don't know whether to believe it or not. But anyhow, it's very, very, very unlikely that any of you will get into jhanas or walking meditation. But if you do start to get still, and you really get still, what forest monks do is they're really getting still. Instead of going back to your seat, just sit right there on the mat, exactly where you are. You're getting so still, the mind is moving inwards. Instead of walking, just sit down and just allow the mind to go in. That's possible. But anyway, just walking backwards and forwards, getting more and more calm, more and more peaceful, until you get into the delightful walking meditation. And to give you some indication of what I mean, this is one of my own personal stories. The first, just become a monk, the first 6 weeks in the monastery where I became a monk, which was in the middle of Bangkok. So they used to have some morning chanting, just, before, maybe an hour or two before lunchtime. And after that was finished, the monks would go off and do whatever they needed to do. And I had no duties, I just was a young monk. So I would stay in the main hall and do walking meditation. And the hall was maybe about this size, not as wide, but maybe just as long, about 16 meters long. And I would just walk from one end to the other on the veranda. And it'd take me half an hour to get from one end to the other. Because there was a grandfather clock which would chime the quarter hours. There always were two chimes before I got to the end. And I'd turn around and go back again, another two chimes. 1 hour of walking meditation, just going about 35 meters or so. And I always used to enjoy that, because I used to get really, really peaceful. On this one occasion, I'd been walking maybe about 45 minutes, just really still, could feel every movement. Every sensation in the foot as it was coming up, and it was just so still and peaceful, having a wonderful time. And I was distracted. I thought I heard a noise somewhere, a sound. Brahma Wang So. That's a real name. Ajahn Brahma is a shortened form. Brahma Wang So is a full name. Brahma Wang So. What it was, there was a monk whose mouth was almost in my ear, trying to get my attention. Because I'd totally forgotten I was supposed to go to like a house dhan or a ceremony. And he was waiting for me, and he'd been sent to come and get me. And they were late. But as for me, I was just, Brahma Wang. It was just so far away, I couldn't really figure out what was going on. So, Brahma Wang So. And then I realized what was going on. And my eyes were 2 meters in front of me. And I always remember this. I realized that there was a monk almost in my ear hole. And I had to sort of turn around. But as I started turning my head, I noticed all these amazing sensations in my neck as it started to move and turn. And I was really trying as hard as I could to go quickly, but I was just stuck in first gear. And there's no way which I could move into even second gear. And he must have thought I was crazy, because it took me about a minute. I go fast. And I turned around to him and said, what? I just couldn't accelerate. You're just so cool and so still and so peaceful. I remember that experience because him talking to me just showed you how still and peaceful you become. Of course we were late, but they didn't mind because they realized I was getting into some nice meditation. Be really, really still. So that might happen to you when you're doing the walking meditation. You're walking in here and there's a sound for lunch, 11 o'clock bell. And you slowly lift your head and you walk because you can't walk fast. and by the time you get to the dining hall, all the food is gone and they've washed up. If that's the case for you, great, it's a wonderful experience. It's much better than eating. So you got really, really still, so you enjoy it. And these experiences that are enjoyable, so it's not sort of tough thing, but the advantage of walking meditation is you don't have the aches and the pains in your body. You know, and you look around here, and there's many of you, you know, you're getting on a bit. And don't look, who's he talking to? Somebody else now talking to you. So because of that, you know, you do get aches, you do get pains, and sometimes sitting for long periods of time, oh, my back aches. Oh, this sort of is not so good. So doing walking meditation is great for the body because it's moving, you don't have physical aches and pains, and you can still get really still. So you use a walking meditation as well as a sitting meditation. And if you make the transition from one to another peacefully, you can collect all that calm, collect all that stillness and not throw it away. And you build up that stillness, you build up the energy of peace throughout the day, walking and sitting, walking and sitting. And it means you really do get some very wonderful states of mind. So now when you finish sitting and you can't sit anymore, don't just go, oh, what should I do? Go and have a cup of tea. Just go and see what's happening in the bush. Go and see, you know, there's a space for an interview. Don't just go and be restless like that. See, walks it, walks it, walks it, walks it, walks it. And that way you really get still and peaceful. You build up the energy, which is brilliant. So that's actually with a walking meditation. There's no, we don't have a schedule here, 1 hour walking or 10 minutes walking or 50 sitting or anything like that. You work it out for yourself, because some people, they can sit for a long time, some people a short time, some people like to walk for a long time, some people walk for a short time. So, you know, because everybody is different, which is obvious, that we have hardly any schedule at all. So you make best use of the time. If you feel that your body is stiff and a bit restless, do some walking. If you feel that you know, you've got lots of energy, then walk fast and get rid of some of that excess energy. If you need to, if you've had too much coffee, do some walking, fast walking. If you really get bored, you sit meditation, it don't work, you walk meditation, it don't work, try walking backwards. That's always good fun. It's just a bit of playing around. You walk backwards, and how far away is that wall behind me? Don't worry, you won't hit your head too hard. The bricks are pretty soft. Imagine they're not that soft, but I think they're softer than some people's heads. So you're not going to really get hurt. So even doing backwards walking meditation, sometimes it's interesting, it's fun, it just makes you really mindful. So you enjoy the meditation, you have some fun with the walking. And that's actually how we can balance, we can overcome that hindrance of a tired, painful body by doing walking. And, yeah? You can wear shoes, but make sure they're very clean, because those, yeah, because sometimes people's feet, they need special shoes to actually to lift up their arches or whatever. So, you know, you wear the shoes. It's probably better not to, if you can, but if you need to, sure you can, but make sure your shoes are really clean, because otherwise they leave lots of dust marks in there. And make sure your shoes haven't got like hobnails and things which scratch everything and tear. So no stilettos. I don't know how you girls can wear those stilettos. That must be a lot of mindfulness not to fall over all the time. Anyway. Just a nice comfortable shoes, fine, if you really want to. Or little slippers. If you've got slippers, that's really nice. Or just, I prefer my, you know, just barefoot, because barefoot you get more sensations on your feet. And after a while you get very, very sensitive, and you can feel the sensation on the bamboo floor. You really feel it on these little mats. These are like yoga mats. So they're soft enough that, you know, you can walk for long periods of time, but they're not that soft. You know, you can actually feel the stiffness of the concrete underneath. So they feel the cold or the warm, or walking on the grass. And that sort of sensations and textures of the different surfaces, you can actually pick them up. It means your feet get really sensitive. And it gets really very interesting and good fun. So yeah, you can wear shoes if you want to. Okay, so that's walking meditation. What are some of the obstacles? Of course, you all know the two main obstacles in meditation. Number one is sleepiness, and the other one is thinking too much. Now, let's put aside all these five hindrances business. You know, the basic, you know, what you're struggling with is either think, or really getting dull and bored. Now, they are connected. Because when I was a young monk, I used to have heaps and heaps of trouble with sloth and torpor. I think I mentioned the first night. And now I realize why. Remember the reasons why I had sloth and torpor? Sleep deprivation, only about 4 hours sleep a night, 4.5 hours if I was lucky. And that was it for the day. You know, it was really, really hot and humid in the jungles of northeast Thailand. And number three, I was malnourished. And the food was disgusting. So, you know, you were really thin. All the monks were really thin. Just before, I don't know, I think when I did come, I was up in the northeast, but, you know, Queen Elizabeth visited Bangkok with Prince Philip. And, you know, the Thai people were just so proud of their Western monks. They got as many English monks as they possibly could, you know, together to have like a meeting with Prince Philip. So this was, I think, 1973 or 4 or something. And then Prince Philip, you know, he talked to these monks, and when he got back again afterwards, you know, he said, I've never seen such an anemic, skinny bunch of blokes in my whole life. And it was true. I saw a photo of all these, you know, people as if they'd just come out of a concentration camp. And that was true because the food was really disgusting. And, you know, Westerners, we couldn't take it. We couldn't absorb it. So we're getting skinny and sick. So that was, you know, you had to be very healthy and very fit and strong. And I was fit and strong. That's why you don't survive those early years. But that was one of the reasons why you were sleepy. You just didn't have enough energy in your system. But what did I do when you were sleepy? You know, one of the first things I did was try the matchbox trick. You know, I got a matchbox, took off the cover with all the matches inside and put it on top of my head. So that means if you nodded, the matchbox would go on the floor, scatter everywhere, and everybody would know. And you'd have to sort of collect all the matchboxes, put them in the box again, and put them back on your head again. So, you know, that was actually training you to make sure you weren't nodding. And, you know, it worked. After about 3 or 4 days, you know, I was sitting there and the matchbox never fell off at all. And that's when after one morning meditation, one of the monks, come over here, Bhamwang sir. You know, the reason why that matchbox isn't falling off your head is not because you've overcome sloth and torpor. He said, I've been watching you. You're still nodding, but when you nod, you go like this. And I never realized that. You know, the whole body was compensating. It was still nodding, but in such a way the matchbox was level, never fell off. You know, it was really disappointing because you thought you'd got somewhere and you hadn't. So the only thing for it usually was actually put forth effort. You know, it's watch what you do. So I really struggled. I am not going to fall asleep. I'm going to watch every breath. And I screwed up my mind and really started generating some force of will. And you could do it. In the sleepiness, you could watch the breath and the sleepiness would try and get you away but wouldn't. And as soon as the sleepiness was finished, you just had all these thoughts going in your head. And you couldn't sort of calm them down. You had to really take a lot of time to calm them down. And as soon as the thoughts had calmed down, no thoughts, I was half asleep again. Isn't that the same with you, many of you? You oscillate between being dull and fantasizing, dreaming, thinking. You can't find that middle path, that space in between. I like to regard this like a pendulum. One extreme is sloth and torpor, dullness. The other extreme is restlessness, thinking too much. And you go from one extreme to the other extreme. You're either dull and the mind is not really alive, or you're thinking too much when it is overly alive. You can't find this beautiful spot in the middle where you're awake, but still. And that was actually the goal of not just overcoming sloth and torpor, replacing it by restlessness. I remember one of these teachers, When I asked him about restlessness, this is what he said. He said, I'll just think about sex and you won't be restless anymore. You won't be dull anymore. Yeah, I know, but I'm a monk. Come on. It's true, if you think of something like that, you're not sleepy at all. But that's not quite the point, is it? So, to try and find that balance, after a while, you know, I cracked it. You realize and understood what was going on. And this is where I've been listening to all these teachings. It's some of the reasons why I keep repeating these teachings. You can say them again and again and again. And it takes 3, 4, 10, 20 times sometimes before it clicks. You get the message. And Ajahn Chah would often say, if you want a healthy body, exercise it. If you want a powerful mind, keep it still. Powerful mind, keep it still. And after a while I realized that's the way of overcoming the sloth and torpor. Not by fighting it, because that's doing things, by keeping it absolutely still. Even if you're dull, don't do anything. Stillness. And I tried that. In the mornings, you had no energy. Don't do anything. You've got a tiny bit of mindfulness, that's enough. But that mindfulness is just to protect that state and not interfere with it. Be absolutely still. And then I noticed from that stillness, the sloth and torpor started to lift, like the mist in the early morning when the sun comes up. The sun just burns off the mist. And that's what my stillness was doing. It was burning off the mist of sloth and torpor. And little by little, the mind became more clear, and clear, and clear, and clear. But because the sloth and torpor was being overcome by stillness, not through force, when it did lift, the stillness remained. So the mind was perfectly poised, in that place I wanted to try and get it, between the extreme of dullness and restlessness. It lifted, and you were peaceful. And then you carried on into some really great meditations. So to this day, I teach that. If you're dull, don't fight it. Don't get negative about it. It all has its causes and effects. Like my dullness, there's nothing wrong with me. It was just, I was a Westerner in a foreign country, in a hot climate, malnourished, without enough sleep. Obvious. The reason you've been dull for the first few days is obvious. How hard you've been working and struggling, rushing around. Of course you'd be dull the first few days. Nothing wrong with you. It's nature, so don't fight nature. Accept it. Make peace with it. If you do things like that, then because you are accepting, making peace, being kind to your dullness, because you're being still with it, slowly it lifts. And when your dullness does lift, you have no problem with restlessness. All that time you've been creating stillness, you've been creating peace. So when the dullness lifts, that's what remains. It's gorgeous peace. You just go even deeper into meditation from there. That's how to overcome dullness. That's the easy one to overcome. The restlessness is much harder. So those of you who have been dull for the first few days, you're doing much, much, much better than those who have been restless. At least you're being peaceful. At least you can let go of something. But those people who just cannot stop thinking, restless, 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 and they get up early in the morning because they can't sleep well, thinking, worrying, complaining, fantasizing, dreaming. And sometimes they're not dull at all, they can sit up very straight, but inside their mind there's all sorts of fun and games going on. They're the ones which are more difficult. So how do you overcome the too much thinking? And it's not the thoughts come into you. It's not, and you can't overcome the thoughts by willpower again. I've seen so often that if you try and stop the thoughts, the restless thoughts, by trying to control them, as I said in that talk a few days ago, my experience having all these unmonkish thoughts, And when I decided just to do that deal and from 3 to 4, okay, you can think whatever you want. And that was just surprising. Now I know exactly why. From 3 to 4 in the afternoon, I said, you can think whatever you like. The most inane, sexual, unmonkish, deviant, weird, any thought you can think from 3 to 4 every afternoon. You may try that yourself. Give yourself 3 to 4 your weird thought hour. And if you try that, you find it's the most peaceful hour of the day. It actually won't work now if you expect it to be peaceful. But for me, I never knew what was going to happen. And I really thought, okay, mind, you can do whatever you want. And it was so still. And it was surprising at the time. Now I know exactly why. Because all that trying to stop those thoughts were feeding them. All that sort of, I don't like those thoughts. I'm a monk. I don't want to think about ex-girlfriends. That was actually feeding it. And when I just, okay, that's fine. It'll be okay. Whatever you want to think is fine by me. You just do what you want. I'm just going to be peaceful. That was actually taking away the energy source from thinking. All thinking comes from negativity, from discontent. I gave it a simile some time ago, that sometimes I've met these elderly couple. And sometimes they go around their house, hardly ever talking with each other. And it's not because they've had an argument and refuse to talk to each other. It's just they know each other so well. They're so content in each other's company. They don't need to speak. As if the other one knows what the other one wants. And just does it. Because they've been together for such a long time. They're so content. There's no need for speech. That's exactly the reason why people think inside their mind. They're just not content, they're not happy. That's to make business, something to do, something to distract themselves. So when you find out the cause of thinking, then instead of worrying about the effect of the thinking, work on the cause, why thoughts come. And the way to overcome that restless mind is developing contentment. And so half the job of a retreat is develop contentment. You know, your stool, you know, is it high enough? Is it the right angle? It's good enough. You know, your cushion, it's good enough. It's, you know, sometimes we get these high-tech chairs. If you read in some of these, I've read in some of these American Buddhist magazines, because there's a huge Buddhist community in the United States. So because there's like, you know what United States is like, because there's a market, there are products. So you can get all these amazing cushions and stools. You know, just the ones we've got over here, and this is like dinosaur age compared to what you can get in Shambhala Sun. You know, these are state of the art, you know, money back guarantee if you don't get jhana after 1 week using our stool. I don't think it goes that far, but you know, sort of give an idea what I'm talking about. The state of the art stools. And state-of-the-art cushions, and it doesn't matter how much energy and research you put into finding just the right angle on your meditation stool, just the right size of cushion, and whether it should be under your left buttock or your right buttock, and how far back or how far forward. It doesn't matter how much energy you put into that, it's still not good enough. And it's all that thinking and thought and worry and restlessness for nothing. And instead, you know, when I was a young monk, we didn't have any cushions at all. Even the concrete, because it was laid by villagers, was lumpy. You know, it wasn't level. And so, you know, part of it would, you know, would cut into your buttocks. Remember that time I had far less buttocks than I have now. It was really thin. It's okay when you're being a more an elderly monk or an elderly man or woman. You know, you've got your own cushion you carry around with you. It's called fat. But those days are really skinny. It was really, but it was good enough. I was content. Because I was content. I never needed anything, never wanted anything. That's why I never thought so much. There's that other little story I like telling about contentment. Now you know that one of the rules for monks and nuns, we're not allowed to have any money. No bank account, no credit cards, no money, no personal funds at all.
And that was a wonderful way for developing contentment. Because I had no money, couldn't buy anything, so I never even thought about it. But there was an exception made by the Buddha. He called it the mendaka allowance. It's even got a name, ask any monk or nun, they know of mendaka allowance. So what that is this. You can say to a monk, or say to a sort of a nun, and I say, Ajahn Wayama, I respect you so much, you've really helped me. Is there anything you need? Not for your temple, not for your monastery, for you. And it's usual to say a figure. Look, $50, $50. I'm holding $50 for you. What do you want, roughly, for about $50? That is allowable. That was allowed by the Buddha. But don't do that. Because this is what happened to me. I was in Thailand. I'd done a service for somebody, and he came up to me and said, Ajahn Brahm, you've really helped me. You've done a great service. I've already given enough donations to the temple for you. 100 baht I've put aside for you. Please tell me what you want roughly for 100 baht. And what's that worth? About $3-4? But anyway, I said, okay. Actually, I couldn't think of anything. You know, because you hadn't had much anyway, you started to think, I don't know. And he started getting a bit sort of restless. And look, I've got a job to go to. Now let me know. And I came up with an idea. I said, look, I will go back to my hut tonight. I'll think about it. You know, you come back tomorrow morning. I'll give you a list. I don't want to waste your time. I just can't think about what I want yet. And he said, oh, great idea. I'll come back same time tomorrow and you give me a list and I'll sort of get it for you the next day. Great deal. So that night, after the chanting, I went back to my hut. I got out a piece of paper. What do I want for 100 baht? And straight away, I looked at the paper which I had. It was just like a bit of scrap paper. What I needed was these exercise books so I could actually write on things. So the first thing I wrote down was exercise book. And then I actually looked at the pencil which I was writing. It was just almost finished. And even pencils were really not good. What I wanted was like a little biro, not expensive one, like a little Bic or something. So the next thing was like a pen. And actually I was writing this by candlelight, because we didn't have any electricity in this monastery. And I was running out of candles, so I was in a packet of candles. And actually I needed some matches, actually, to light those candles. But actually matches, because in the northeast, especially in winter time, it rains so much. You know, the matches take up the moisture, and you know, the little red things on the end, they all sort of just disintegrate, so they're pretty hopeless. I wanted one of those cigarette lighters, so I wrote down cigarette lighter. And then I sort of thought, actually, when it comes to lights, you know, my flashlight is also, you know, on the blink, it's not really working, so I wrote down flashlight. And then I suddenly realized 100 baht wasn't enough. But before I could take something else, I need batteries for the flashlight too. And actually, it's not when I use the flashlight and the batteries, you know, to walk back from my hut to the hall, which is maybe about 100 meters, 150 meters. You know, my shoes are falling apart, I need a new set of thongs. And all these things kept on appearing on the list. And, you know, there's too many for 100 baht, so I had to decide, which one should I take off? And I couldn't take any of them off. Because once you actually thought about them, actually you wondered how ever you could survive without them. And I couldn't take anything off. And at the same time, more and more things were coming into my head, and I was writing them down, and soon 1,000 baht wasn't enough. And at that point, I got the message. And I took that paper, and I screwed it up. And I threw it into the bin with venom. And when that guy came the next day, I went up to him and said, don't you ever do that to me again. Because I had been such a happy monk before. I didn't have anything, and so I never thought about it. And now he'd given me the opportunity to get something, and oh, it's just crazy. So I really feel for you guys who's got money. Because I know, no matter how much you've got, it's not enough, is it? You always want more. And however much you get, if you win the lottery, it's still not enough. Isn't it the case? Every person who wins the lottery buys a ticket the next week. It's well known. It's never enough. So, it's best to... I quit while I'm ahead, when I've got nothing at all. I know it's not enough. It never will be. Because I haven't got anything. I can't think about anything. Isn't that great? Got nothing to think about because I've got no money to get it. So what? Forget about it. So have you noticed all thinking is about discontent? When you're content, it doesn't matter how much you've got. Me, I've got nothing. And I can be content with that. You've got far more than I've got. Can't you be content with that? How many clothes have you got? So amazing, I saw some of you coming in here with about 3 or 4 bags. You know, you've got your morning meditation gear, your afternoon meditation gear, you know, your evening meditation dress. How much do you really need? And of course, that's all thinking every time you want something. It's all because of discontent. You think, what can I get next? So the way to overcome thinking is being content. If you want a nice little mantra, which works very, very well, when you're meditating, when you're walking, when you're going back to your room or going to lunch, this is good enough. This is good enough. This is good enough. You get content. Nothing to think about. Your stool is good enough. This retreat center, good enough. The food, good enough. Your bed, good enough. Your meditation, good enough. Why can't you say that? If you say it's not good enough, then you'll start thinking. If you say this is good enough for me, who do I think? I'm only a lay person, you know, I'm only sort of old, I'm Western, I'm not going to get enlightened. No way in the world. Then you've got a real good chance of getting enlightened. You just say, oh, this is good enough for me. And it's good enough for me. You're content. You're just here sitting down, having a nice time. Imagine all of you, you know, if you're Singapore, you don't have to go to work today. Think of all those other losers out there. You know, they're at their office desk right now in front of the computer, you know, worrying about this and worrying about that. Isn't it good enough just you don't have to go to work? It's Monday, for goodness sake. You're free. Woo! And those of you, so there's more women here, who sort of know wives, I've got no husband to look after today. Yeah! You know how hard that is. Of course you know. You don't have to do that. You know, Bianca's doing all the cooking and other people doing the washing up. You're totally free. That's not good enough. This is brilliant. I'm going to kind of ask Ajahn Bob, can we extend the retreat for another 10 days? So when you're grateful, you've got no kids to worry about, or your mothers and fathers. Isn't it brilliant? Just sometimes the kids, yeah, you love them to bits, but sometimes they drive you crazy. Nothing to worry about. Brilliant. As for me, I've got no monks to worry about. I don't know what they're up to over there, but they can just, whatever they want to do, have parties, I don't know. Now, they're all really, really good monks over there. So it's brilliant when you've got no, none of my business, this is good enough. Everything gets very quiet and calm. It stops your thinking. So all thinking comes from discontent. So what happens when you are restless? I don't want to be restless. You are creating more discontent. That's why one of the great ways of overcoming thinking is being content to think. Mind wants to think, fine by me. I'm content, this is good enough that you're thinking. You're taking away the cause. It's like you're driving a car and you turn off the gas. The car can't go much further without gas. Without discontent, thinking doesn't last very long. So, if you're thinking, content, okay, off you go, that's fine by me. You can think if you want. Don't have to if you don't want to. Totally content. I don't mean you're enjoying the thinking. That's not being content. Content, no, you think if you want. Don't have to if you don't want to. None of my business. Good enough for me. Then thinking stops. So if your obstacle is too much thinking, don't sort of attack the thoughts. Attack the causes of the thoughts. Where the thoughts come from. It's all discontent. All wanting something. And if you can just say, this is good enough for me, develop the beautiful contentment, just be happy to be here. Grateful that, you know, little things, you have no husband, no wife, no kids, no job, nothing to look after, perfectly free. Ah, this is bliss. Then you're content. then you don't need to think anymore. And then that obstacle is totally overcome. So that's how to overcome thinking and how to overcome dullness. Dullness is overcome by stillness. Thinking is overcome by contentment. Check it out and see if what I'm saying is true. Okay, any questions there? What do you think about that? Always trick questions. But anyway, if you have any questions, you can write them on a piece of paper and they will be answered to the best of my ability this evening. So, now's the time. Nothing to do, you might as well sit here. If you don't want to sit here, might as well walk. Nothing much to do. You're not going to go anywhere. You're not going to get anything. So just enjoy the moment. You're not going to get enlightened. You're not going to get in jhanas. So give up. Give up now. As soon as possible. And then they'll come. Okay, have some nice meditation.